Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this is another regular old episode. We're talking about an award winner. This time it is the 2014 Nebula winner, which is Annihilation by Jeff Vandermeer. And my guest is Matthias from the Nebulugo Book Club Discord. So, hey there, man. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Seth. A longtime listener, second time talker.
Yes. Yeah. I had you on for one of the panel episodes that we did this year. And you and I have met in person as well in Portland, which is cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
So maybe why don't you talk a little bit about the book club?
Yeah. So I am the current leader of the Nebulugo Book Club on Discord. Started December of 2019. And the whole point is we're going to read all the Hugo and or Nebula award-winning novels. And then we kind of expanded into their series as well. I've got well over 100 books under our belts, and it is still going strong. It's my favorite place on the internet.
It's a really cool place on the internet, and there's lots of tangent discussions and buddy reads and all kinds of stuff. So it's really a good place to hang out. So I'll encourage people. I'll get a link from Discord. If people want a link, they can reach out to you or me, and we can get them in there.
Great. Yeah. The more, the merrier.
What about you as a science fiction fan? What's some of your history? How far back does the nerdery go?
Oof, that would have been gone from probably before I can remember. My father was a humongous reader. He would bring home like a couple books for the weekend and be done with them Sunday night. He loves movies and stories, and that really got put into me. I think that really goes back, maybe not sci-fi, but he read The Hobbit to my sister and I when I was, kindergarten, first grade, and I was fascinated, just absolutely fascinated. I'd read some, kiddie sort of sci-fi stuff like Teach Rate My Brain, Teach Rate My Homework, stuff like that. And then I think it was fourth grade, I tried to read Lord of the Rings. Yeah, that took me like 2 years, and I did not understand what was going on in there. I just remember being very disappointed when Gandalf died. I was like, I'm done. I don't want to finish these books. What happened here? But yeah, so I've been a constant reader pretty much my whole life. Yeah, I usually read something every day.
And didn't you tell me, was there a Powell's Books connection to the start of the Discord or your journey to try and read them all?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. So my father would take my sister and I to Powell's Books downtown Portland all the time. And in their fantasy sci-fi room there, it was a giant supporting pillar. And someone had written on one of the sides and kind of diagonally all the Hugo Award winners. And then on the next quarter panel of that pillar, they had written the Nebula Award winners. And I remember, in my early 20s, like going to Powell's looking for a book. And I'm like, well, let's see what these award winners are. And I'd pick out like Dune or something. I'm like, oh, that was really good. So I started, reading more and more of them. And it was July of 2019. I decided, I'm going to read all those. I'm going to read all those Hugos and all those Nebulas. And it was just a few months later, somebody on Reddit said, hey, I'm going to create a Discord book club for Hugo and Nebula Reads. And I was like, I'm already on that journey. This is perfect. I'd never been on Discord. I didn't know how it worked. And I stumbled a lot those first few months. But then they ended up wandering off and I became a moderator. And then some of the other moderators wandered off. We still have Captain Cat as a moderator. Shout out to Captain for being there from the very first day. And then I just kind of took over being the leader because I was the one making all the graphs and the paperwork and putting up all the notices and stuff. And then Captain Cat kind of, sat back. I think they're in school and stuff, college or whatever. And I've kind of become the leader. And it's odd because I didn't, plan to be the leader of anything.
Right.
But it's nice because, now that I have finished all those Hugos and those Nebulas, people, when we read a new book, it's easy to jump in and be like, oh, I like this part or I like that part, instead of being like, oh, I haven't read that one yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool. And I was going to let you brag about the fact that you're one of the, what is it, Stella Magus, that somebody who has read all of them.
Yes.
The gloss put on your name.
Yeah. If you read the Hugos, you become a commander. If you read the Nebulas, which no one has done yet, just the Nebulas, you become an alchemist. And then if you read them both, you become a stellar magus. It was just something fun I thought about doing a few years ago. But like, let's give people, you know, some sort of reward for having finished one of these lists. And people like it. I remember I heard J.W. Wartick on your show one time. And he was like, that was a really proud day when I got that stellar magus. And I love that you, I think you brought him into the book club.
Yeah. 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 I brought in a few.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. And it was like the first day he figured out that you get those things like, oh, I've actually read all of them already. And I'm like, great. Look at this guy walks in with a title. I love it.
Yeah, that's cool. And you finished the Nebulas this year, right?
Yes, that's right. I finished the Nebulas November 23rd. I finished the last one, Seeker, by Jack McDivitt from the Alex Benedict series. What a great finish. I remember when I finished
that. That was 2024 then.
I finished, yes, thank you. I finished the Nebulas July 9th of this year, 2025. I finished the Hugos in November 23rd of 2023. And that ended not on a good book. So I knew that when I was going to finish up the Nebulas, I was putting aside what I thought could be good and reading the things I knew was not going to be liking for me. So it was nice to end on something good instead of being like, oh.
I will tell people one of the cool things, too, is the finish line channel. So when people finish reading all the Nebulas or all the Hugos, they can go over there and kind of give their breakdown of, you know, what order they prefer things in. I mean, what their rankings of everything. I actually don't think I ever did that. So I wanted to get some distance from it before I went back and kind of did that. So one of these days I'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah. The winner's circle. I remember the first person who did it, they wrote up like 4 or 5 pages. It was like a mini synopsis on every book. And I was like, wow, you really set the bar high on that one. Yeah. So when it came time for me, I waited like a year to even put up the Nebulas. I was like, cause I couldn't compete with that. I'm not much of a writer.
Yeah.
And so when I did it, I think I just did like a tier list and I was like, it's pretty weak of me. I should probably go back and do something bigger one of these days.
I kind of want to do the tier list. So because I like that idea of grouping stuff into like, these are the ones I absolutely loved. These are the ones that I think I would want to do a tier of. These are ones I probably should revisit because there are books. I was listening actually recently, shout out to Hugo History, which is a podcast I just discovered, and we're already planning to do some kind of a crossover.
Cool.
But I was listening to her episode on The Big Time, and that was one that I bounced off of. And
same.
At least one of them on that book said, I kind of bounced off the first time, and then I reread it and really kind of got what Fritz Leiber was doing. And I was like, well, dang it, man. Now I wish I could, I could obviously go back and reread. I know you're not a big rereader of books.
I am not, but I have reread Annihilation 4 times, mostly because of this book club for you. And I've listened to it twice. I don't really like listening to books, but I did a quick listen to it just finished a couple days ago, just really kind of slowly working my way through, just trying to pick up anything new. And I did. I picked up a couple of interesting things, which we'll talk about later.
We'll get to those, yeah. Okay, so let's talk Annihilation, because this is the first book in a trilogy. And there was a new book out, I think, in either 2024 or 2025. I think it was this year, right?
Absolution, the fourth book, came out almost exactly 1 year ago from today.
Okay. Excellent. So what's your history with this title? What drew you to this one in terms of when we started talking about doing an episode all that time ago?
Yeah. You had already finished reading all the Hugos, and then you had sent me a copy of your Mondo list, which is, what was it, 400 books you wanted to read? It was huge. And I started going through it. I think I started at A and I was like, Annihilation? Yeah, I love that book. That was the first book I read cover to cover in one day. I'm a pretty slow reader, 20, 30 pages an hour. But that book, I sat outside. It was like during COVID, so I wasn't doing anything all day. But I went outside to the sun and sat down around noon and opened it up. And I remember finishing it before midnight, just thinking, wow. What an amazing story. I was so drawn in by the mystery and the ambiance of the story. I've never had anything ever catch me that hard, that quick. And really, I mean, the very first line drew me in because I'd seen the movie and I liked the movie. I was like, man, that was a really cool movie. Mm-hmm. And now looking back at it, I think the coolest things in the movie don't actually show up in the book, but you know, that's okay. It's interpretations, creative licenses. Yeah, that first line. Hey, can I read the first line for you?
Yeah, go for it.
Because I think it was just such a fascinating jump in, even from the book's perspective. But if you'd seen the movie, the very first line is going to throw you for a loop. You're going to be like, wait, what is going on here? And that I think that also really drew me, because I was like, well, this is not what I saw on the screen. Mm-hmm. First line, the tower, which was not supposed to be there, plunges into the earth in a place just beyond before the black pine forests begin to give way to the swamp and the reeds and the wind-gnarled trees of the marsh flats. A little bit more here. Beyond the marsh flats and the natural canals lies the ocean, and a little farther down the coast, a derelict lighthouse. All of the parts of the country had been abandoned for decades for reasons that were not easy to relate. Our expedition was the first to enter Area X for more than 2 years, and much of the predecessor's equipment had rusted, their tents and sheds little more than husks. Looking out over the untroubled landscape, I did not believe any of us could see the threat yet. Hmm. Wow. I just so hooked, like, well, there was no underground tower in the movie. What is an underground tower? What does that look like?
Right. Yeah.
Hooked right away. And I also like that it sets up the Area X a little bit. You know, there's pristine wilderness, the transitional areas from forest to swamp to canals to ocean. And I think transition is the biggest part of the story. It's the through thread. I can't say the right words, but everything is in transition. Things are always changing. And I think that is... when I reread it again, I just thought, yeah, everything is changing. Nothing is staying the same. Everything is moving, being metamorphosized. Yeah.
And so kind of this is one that I had seen the movie first as well. And then I'd been wanting to read it. And I think I had started reading it a couple of times. And so when you picked it, I thought, okay, that's great. And we've had lots of trouble scheduling stuff over the last, you know, year and a half or whatever, where something would come up for one or the other of us. And it's just, we just kept kicking the ball down the road. And so I think on the way to Worldcon in Scotland, I had gotten the book out and I read fully half of it on that flight. But I'm not the kind of person I find airplane reading a little distracting. And like I'm a little distracted, you know, cause they come around with food service or you start falling asleep or something. And so I switch like every few hours, I like to switch to a graphic novel or something else. And so I got through half the book and I fully intended to read the other half on the return flight, but I got to reading something else. It was a World War II history book and I'm a middle-aged man. So I am what I am. So I never really got back to it. And then I thought, okay, we're going to record this soon. We were going to do it right after Worldcon. And then, like I said, we had all kinds of scheduling problems. I think you had an illness or a hospitalization or something or some family issues. And so I just didn't get back to it. And then by the time then we're like, okay, we're doing this. We're going to do it. I was like, you know what? I don't remember what happened in the first half of that book. So I pick up the audio. And I like to use audio to kind of review things. Right. And I think I had one of those days where I was just doing a ton of yard work and I blasted through the entire thing in a day. On audio, it's easy to do that, right? Especially if you're somebody like me who listens at 2x speed. And so then I went back to the middle of the book where I'd left off and read it in print. And I thought, okay, now I'm ready. And then we kicked it down the road. And so then we tried to schedule it again, listen to the audiobook again. So I'm on now one, I've read it in print one time and I've listened to the audiobook three times, including this week.
So, right behind me.
Yeah. And you'd think after all of that, I would have more defined thoughts about the book. But one of the struggles about like airplane reading or listening to audiobook is I have a harder time taking down notes because I'll think of something. You know, if I'm reading something in print under normal circumstances and I think, oh, that's something I'll want to talk about, I'll just jot it down on my phone. Right. On the airplane, I didn't do that. And then with audio, it's a little harder to do that because I might be driving my car or doing yard work or something. And so I don't find myself getting those notes down. So I'll depend on you to kind of tell me what we should talk about the book. It's a very, I will say, like, I like the book. I definitely like it. I like the experience of reading it. If you ask me to give a plot synopsis, I think I would have a hard time, but it like you said, it is one that pulls you into like the atmosphere of it. It reminded me of a little bit of Roadside Picnic, the Strugatsky.
I haven't read that yet.
One. Okay.
I'll get to it one of these
it's
days.
It's just another thing where there's a zone, right?
Okay.
Or Alien Clay from this year.
Yeah, I remember you. Yeah, you would say you made that link. I kind of get it. Yeah, it's like an unknown place with mysterious flora and fauna, and a lot of mysteries that don't really get answers. But it's about the journey. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It also reminded me a little bit of there's a Dean Koontz book called The Taking, I think, where that was one of those ones where I read when I was ill one day on a rainy day in Oregon, and in the book it's raining the whole time, and it just seeped into my brain. I read the whole thing, and it also has like mysterious biology stuff going on, and so it very much evoked that that kind of feeling for me, but. Yeah, so why don't we kick off the kind of non-spoiler portion of this and talk about, like, what is this book actually about? And you might want to situate it in terms of the fact that it is a trilogy, and I know you have some background about the trilogy.
Yes, so it came out in 2014. And what's really interesting is that the three books in the original trilogy got published just months apart. Which is really interesting. I didn't look into it too hard, but that to me means that Jeff Vandermeer had all these books already written. If not, the last one was just mostly done, is doing some final editing on it, or someone else doing editing. But the first book, Annihilation, got published, and then it was like 3 or 4 months later the second book came out, and then 3 or 4 months later the next book came out. It's sort of unprecedented in publishing to have a trilogy come out like that. Unless you're already like a super famous person. And I'm pretty sure Jeff was not a super famous person when these books came out. Somebody said it was they said it was something like when Netflix puts out a trilogy just months after each other. That's how these books got published. I mean, good for him, because I really like the series. The first book kind of reminds me of like an X-Files episode where Scully is out on an away mission or whatever, checking out some mysterious place kind of all by herself with, well, there's some other people there, but Mulder is not there. Mulder would be his adventure back at the office for book two, but let's not jump into book two. We're going to stick with the book today. It also kind of reminds me of like a Twilight Zone or an Outer Limits sort of episode, because it is a pretty short book. Pretty sure. I mean, it must, if it's not a novella, it must meet just the exact word count for a novel.
Yeah. It's like the audiobook is like 7 hours, right? Or something like that.
Yeah. Like 6.5. It is short, real short. Yep. But I like that because it's tight. It keeps its focus. It kind of also reminded me, and you just sort of the 2017 UK movie called The Ritual, where these guys go out on a camping expedition and really weird stuff happens out in the forest. Mm. And that's kind of this book, like you're going out into nature and then unforeseen, unknowable, unexplainable things happen. And people go missing and stuff. I did write an elevator pitch. I know you kind of like those.
Yeah. Let's hear it.
I wrote this earlier today, so it's going to be decent. Four specialists, an anthropologist, a surveyor, a psychologist, and a biologist, join the newest expedition into an uninhabited, pristine wilderness known solely as Area X, all funded by a clandestine government agency known as the Southern Reach. Area X is a transitional space of immense biodiversity, an area of black pine forests, of swamps, of marsh flats, natural canals, the ocean, and an explosion of plants and animals. But when they find a tower plunging into the earth that should not be there, that is on none of their maps, their sense of wonder and fear grow into something none of them can control. Because within the area, something crawls, something unknown and seemingly unknowable. As the team explores Area X, their sense of the uncanny erupts through hypnosis, obfuscation, and the incredible flora and fauna that they find. The effects of this cannot be understood without being there. The beauty of it cannot be understood either. And when you see beauty in desolation, it changes something inside you. Desolation tries to colonize you.
Nicely done.
Thank you. Worked on that for about an hour.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. In terms of the kind of the way the book is structured, it's a first person narrative from the biologist, right? You never learn anybody's names.
Right. So let's talk about that. So it is written as if it was their journal while doing the excursion into Area X. Everybody's given a journal to write down their thoughts, and they're not supposed to share each other's thoughts and what they're writing in their journal to try to keep some sort of objectivity in there. So it's not a found footage, but it's like a found bookish. But yeah, it's, can't think of the right word, but yeah, it's
epistolary. Really.
That's the word.
Kind
Thank
of,
you.
Kind of that structure, but a little less formally, right? You don't have like, you know, to my dearest Lucy, kind of stuff in there, right?
Right. Yeah. No newspaper clippings or anything like that, mm-hmm. but it does set that up that you are learning everything from the biologist's viewpoint and what they think they saw and what they thought they heard and felt, which a lot of people say they're an unreliable narrator.
Yes. I was just going to go there.
So I found two very interesting things, one to confirm that and one to refute that. So about a year ago when Jeff Vandermeer was here in Portland, he was at Powell's Books doing a signing and talking about the fourth book in the series. And someone had asked him about the unreliable narrator. And he said, no, they are not an unreliable narrator. They wrote down what they thought was important, what they thought was needed to be said. And I kind of stewed on that for like months. I'm thinking everybody I see online, everybody I talked about this book says unreliable narrator. Mm-hmm. Yet the author refutes that. But then I found something in the book while going over it earlier today, page 115. That night, even though I had come up with thousands of excuses to blame others, I knew I had screwed up. Not filing reports, not sticking to the focus of the job, recording odd data from the periphery, nothing that might satisfy the organization that had provided the grant. I was the queen of the title pools, and what I said was the law, and what I reported was what I wanted to report. I had gotten sidetracked, like I always did, because I melted into the surroundings and could not remain separate from, apart from, objectivity of foreign land to me. So the character themselves, the biologist, sort of says, I give you what I want to give you. I'm the queen of this story.
I would say, I was just listening. I listened to the last hour of it again today.
Yeah.
I think you had mentioned that you were going to do that. And I'm like, yep, you know what? I'm going to do that as well. Because when she's relating that, that's a memory of her previous job.
Right. A couple years
before
ago.
She went to Area X. Right. But it does go to some of the, like how the character sees things. Right. And what I would say is, you know, I'm very death of the author. And so I don't really care what the author thinks.
Okay.
But even so, you can still look at what does it mean to be an unreliable narrator? It can mean that you're deliberately deceiving people.
Could be.
That's one thing. Right. And I don't think necessarily, I think what Vandermeer said is she's not deliberately trying to deceive. However, she over and over kind of talks about the brightness in her, right? And we'll get to that more in spoilers. But I don't think she necessarily sees herself as a reliable narrator, even though she is writing down her honest thoughts about things. But she doesn't know how much they're being affected.
Right, because at the end she says she wrote all this after pretty much the entire story happens. So as we go through the story a little bit, you'll understand she has been affected somehow. So how can we rely on her to be human, to be what she was before the story started? Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's not like reading the diary of a madman or a madwoman in this respect, but they're not like you and me. Just the character themselves. Like their upbringing, they're very antisocial. They don't really like people. They like being out in the forest. They like being out in the tidal pools. And those are the things that fascinate them. And it kind of reminds me, Jeff was saying that she wrote down in her journal the things that she thought were important. So a lot of us readers will look at a scene and think, well, but how did everybody else react to that? But it was never written down because it wasn't important to the biologist.
Right. So real quick, I want to get over into spoilers pretty quickly here. I know we've been going a while.
You're fine.
But do the future books show different perspectives other than the biologists? It sounded like the second book does.
Yeah. So the second book is about a totally different character named Control, which is interesting because you listened to the last hour of the audiobook, and I think it was right around that same paragraph I just talked about the being the queen of the tidal pools. She said she doesn't like Control and she never wanted Control, which I wonder if that was an allusion to book two, because it had already been written by the time the first one was published.
Mm.
So book two is kind of, it's if book one is Scully out on an adventure in a strange place, book two is Mulder back at the office dealing with office politics and all the weirdos who hang out there back at the Southern Reach. It is creepy and atmospheric. I found it incredibly boring. I was okay. just pushing myself through. I did not like the second one. But the third one, those two main characters, the biologist, Ghostbird, and then Control, end up meeting in Area X, and things go back closer towards the first book. You're mostly in Area X, and things are getting wilder and weirder and stranger, and okay. they are both changing. Fourth okay. book. The fourth book is just off the rails. It felt like the diary of a madman. It was just a bunch of gibbering, okay. insane, weird stuff. I don't really remember it that well because I went to that book signing and I got the signed first edition hard copy. And as soon as I got home, I realized I can never open this book. I'm gonna damage it the moment I open the book. So I found an audio. And the first time I ever listened to an audiobook that I'd never read the book for, and my mind was just wandering around, and I just remember glimpses and pieces of it. Bronson Pinchot is a great audiobook reader, people. If you ever get a chance, mm-hmm. get anything by that guy. He was great.
Yeah, my last episode that went up was on Glory Road by Heinlein, and it was Bronson Pinchot. Okay, let's go ahead and get right over into spoilers, and we can talk okay. about anything else that we want to the rest of the way. So.
Great.
I recommend the book. I think it's interesting. I will at some point, I think I've got library holds in for the other two books, or three, I guess. I guess I only have for the other two, but eventually I'll get to them. So, and it sounds like it's a recommend from you as well.
The first book, 5-star, 5 out of 5. I absolutely okay. loved it. Again, read it all in one day. Second book, 3 out of 5 stars because it wasn't for me. Fourth book, 4 out of 5 stars. It gives you a lot of answers, which everybody wants after reading Annihilation. You want answers because every yeah. question that comes up just creates two more questions. And you're like, wait a second, mm-hmm. but if that's true, then what about this and that? And it's also interesting how the biologist keeps speculating about what's going on here and what's happening. And as I was going back to that last hour again today, so many of the things they said were right and so many things they said were wrong, which I think is a great thing for the author to have done because they already knew the end of the story. So they were kind of pushing you and pulling you, but never giving you what you wanted, which, again, I loved it. I loved the mystery of it all.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Full spoilers.
Okay.
One thing I want to mention is kind of going back to the unreliable narrator thing is – yeah. The biologist realizes that the information she's been given is quite unreliable. And
yes.
at several places, you're like, well, wait, how long has Area X been here? How many expeditions have gone in here? Because they think that they're like the 12th?
Right, exactly.
Expedition.
12th. Yep.
But later on, they find evidence that, wow, no, there's been a lot more people in here than I thought.
Yeah, like 100 expeditions. And you'll get those sort of answers in book 3, I think,
okay.
maybe 2.
Okay.
But that does really – that part at least gets fleshed out. But yeah, they – I mean, at the beginning, you're talking about being hypnotized by the psychologist who works for the Southern Reach. And then you're thinking, wait a sec. People are being hypnotized, but it was supposed to be to help them get through the barrier into Area X. But then they find that tower right at the beginning, and then they go down there. And when they go down there, they see those words scrawled on the wall made out of fruiting bodies. It's like a
– Yeah. Oh, all yeah, the – where lies the strangling fruit stuff?
Yes. I've got that all down here. We can maybe get to that at the end.
Okay.
But yeah, as they're getting close to examine the writing on the walls, one of the spores bursts and the biologist accidentally inhales and it gets into her. And now she's infected. Everything from that point on really makes me question what is really going on, because now we're getting a story from someone who's been infected by yeah. what we don't know. Is it aliens?
Yeah.
Is it the occult? And the words on the wall have a sort of sermony feel to it.
Yeah. It reads like apocalyptic prophecy or something.
Yeah. Yeah, really, really cool. I kind of also like that it's just like a massive run-on sentence with like a couple of pyramid periods here and there, but it just goes on and on and on. And you, as the reader, don't really get to see it in full, I don't think ever. You just get bits and pieces here. So if you were paying attention, you could start kind of stitch them together, but I went online and found it all. Yeah, so that moment when they're down in the tower and she inhales those spores, she starts to feel changed. You said there's a light sort of coming out of her, and it yeah. builds up over the next few days. The story is kind of short. It's only like 3 or 4 days of the actual adventure, even though they've been in Area X for 4 days before the story starts. And that's kind of when they come out of their hypnosis feelings.
And
the spores affected the biologists so that they are no longer able to be susceptible to the hypnotic devices. And they realize that right away. And then they're like, wait, I need to fake hypnosis, because they need answers. Mm-hmm. They're like, why are we being messed with here? Why? What is going on here? Yeah. A lot of strange questions about, who are these people? The biologist says she knows their names, but there's no reason to tell you, because most of them are going to die in the next couple of days. Again, that's like the first chapter. You're like, okay, cool. What's going on here?
Well, even more than that is the book keeps flashing back to kind of her relationship, her troubled, difficult relationship with her husband, who had gone on a previous expedition. And
the 11th expedition.
Yeah. And then came back and was only there for a short time before, I think she made the call for them to come pick him up.
Yeah. He comes back. He is not himself. He giant gaps in his memory. When he comes back, she doesn't want to ruin the magic, because he's been gone for some like 6 months or a year, and he just shows up. They have no idea where he's been. He can't explain it. And she tries to have a normal day. She makes dinner. They're reading books. They're playing board games. This is not what I would be doing, but the biologist is not us. They're a very strange person. And they realize that, I think that she says, I took him upstairs and I jumped on top of him and made him do it or whatever. And he just wasn't there. Like, the light in his eyes was not there. And she realized, this is not my husband. I don't know what this thing is, but I don't want to scare it. I don't want to end this moment. But she does call the authorities, and they pick him up in less than 24 hours. He goes to the facility at the Southern Reach, and they're doing tests on him. He gets systemic cancer. Everybody from his expedition who had come back, most of them did come back within a few months to their own homes. They can't explain how they got there hundreds of miles away. But they all got systemic cancer and died within 6 months. And that's why she signed up to be on the next one, because she needed to know what was going on in there. What happened to him? Who is this person? Mm-hmm. And then she finds his diary.
Yeah. When she finds his diary and finds the plea from him, did he say that to her before he left? If I don't come back, will you come in after me?
Yes, he did say that.
He did.
And then when she found his diary, it was written mostly to her, which was even odder. Because it's always like, Ghostbird. He calls her Ghostbird because she's a weirdo. Ghostbird comes back in part 3, and it makes a lot of sense why he called her that. So when she finds it, she starts getting some answers. But again, every answer brings up 3 more questions. Every question brings up a question. Every answer brings up a question.
Yeah. And that's where, she finds the cache of all the journals and discovers that there's 10 times as many missions in there as she thought.
Yeah, she's wading through all the books. There's just so many. She's hip deep in these books. Finds them at the top of the lighthouse, which I think is sort of a mirror of the tower, the underground tower. Somehow the idea of the thing became twisted and changed and moved in space. Although there is some weird time manipulation within the book as well. Somebody's talking about walking out of Area X for a week and they come back to base camp in 1 day. Like, they walked 7 days away and they came back in 1 day. They're like, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that idea of the symmetry between the lighthouse and the tower. And from the first time the biologist sees this, it's a tunnel that goes down into the earth, right? And she always had seen it as a tower. And I don't know, as the reader, I was like, well, she's right. Why don't they all see it that way? Because the rest of them are like, you mean the tunnel? It's just, no, the tower.
And it's like an inverted lighthouse, because it's got the steps spiraling down. It's got the different levels. And then towards the end of the book, we see kind of how far it goes down. But let's come to the end a little bit later, because I was very shocked about what happened at the end. I loved all the little kind of mini adventures that happened within the book. When we meet the boar, second chapter, they see
when it charges them,
some wild boar, and they're talking about how it. The way it looks, the way it feels, the way it's looking at them is not how a normal animal would look. It's not how a normal animal would feel. And it's charging at them, and they're the surveyor has the gun out, the rifle out, and the psychologist is like, "Don't touch it! Don't let it touch you!" And it's you're like, "Whoa, what's going on here? Why is this such a big deal?" And at the last minute, it veers away, and then it's over. Which was it was just so weird, and that happens a lot. Like she talks about the look in its eye, how. Mm-hmm. The look in its eye almost seemed human.
Wasn't there a fish as well, or something in the
dolphin.
Water? A dolphin, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. A little bit later, I think third chapter, whatever, she sees some ripples in the water, and then a pink dolphin like kind of pokes its head out, but it rolls its eye towards her, an eye that looks ominously human. And as we're going through the story, she does take samples of things, and she took samples of some moss and a fox, and both of them had human DNA in them.
Yeah.
So things, living things are being transmogrified into other living things, but there's still pieces of them in there. And that's the transition that I think is just such a big part of the story. But yeah, those are the two creatures. It was the dolphin and the boar that seemed human-like. And then there's the moaner out in the marshes. I don't think we ever did get to see what the moaner is in this book, but book three does explain it, which is, again, shocking. All the questions you have that are answered in book three are just shock after revelation after shock. But then again, at the end, you don't have all the answers. You're like, oh, man, what's going on here?
You're selling me on that.
Yeah. Third one's great. Just got to push that second one. And there's some people in our book club who said they love the second one the best. And I'm just like baffled. But that's the cool thing about a book club. We can see each other's differing opinions and have, humane conversations about them.
Mm-hmm. You get the impression at some point that the psychologist, right, also had some kind of modification, right? Because she could see the brightness, the biologist. It's at least vaguely hinted at.
Yeah. So the psychologist is the one hypnotizing them. And because they are hypnotized, that's why when they go down the tower, they see it as being made out of coral and concrete or something. But after the biologist gets infected with the spores off of the writing on the wall, they start seeing the tower as something living, like a throat.
It's moving, right?
The walls feel like flesh, and she feels a heartbeat pounding in them. One point she leans against the wall, and the wall leans away from her. So it's living. It's not. Again, that's the transition between life and non-life. Everything is becoming alive. And in very strange, interesting ways. But I think that's why the psychologist does see everything for what it really is. They have not been hypnotized by themselves in that degree, where everyone else has been hypnotized to control them, to make them more docile, to try to get them in there and get some answers and get out instead of just being freaked out by every little bug and every little blade of grass. Because things are really, really weird in there. Really weird.
Yeah, yeah. So during the expedition, right, it starts off with the four of them. And then at some point, the linguist, I think, turns back, or at least allegedly turns back. She turns up later.
We start out with five people. I've got this written down here. It was the four we mentioned. It was the biologist, the anthropologist, the surveyor, and the psychologist. And they had a linguist, but the morning of when they're going to go into Area X, they're doing their final, I think it was hypnotism. They didn't really explain it, but they were being hypnotized. And then for some reason, the linguist backed out and they never went into Area X. And then when they find the writing on the wall, they're like, man, kind of wish we had a linguist. But the 11th expedition with her husband, a biologist's husband, did have a linguist in their list, and it didn't really seem to help him anyway. So, there's that.
Yeah. So then is it the anthropologist that goes missing later?
One of those first nights, the anthropologist goes missing, and the psychologist, the leader, says they had a change of mind. They went back home. But later on, we find out when the surveyor and the biologist are going down into the tower, doing further and further explorations deeper down in there, they find footprints in this slime that's all over the lower sets of stairs. And as they're exploring farther and farther, they find a body. And they notice the footprints are their own, like, Southern Reach issued boots. And they're like, what the heck?
Right. But they haven't gone that far forward yet.
Right. And then when they go a little farther, they find a slumped body and they're freaking out because they don't know what it is. And they see it was the anthropologist, and like their jaw had been ripped open and all the exposed flesh was now like a carpet of like green moss that was like trailing down their body. And so they're already being changed even in death. Yeah. And you find out later is because the psychologist took the anthropologist through hypnosis again that night when the other two were sleeping, took them back into the tower, sent them down in there. And when they must have been kind of side by side-ish, but like they, of course, the psychologist is being the safer one. They were like, I'm going to get out of here. I don't care about these other people. They sent the anthropologist a little farther and they saw the crawler, this thing that is, you know, the master of the tower or whatever. Not a great description of what it looks like in this book, but if you get to part three, is a very, very vivid description. You're like, wow, that is even weirder than I thought. But I think it's also evolved by that point because it's like bigger and there's just more. It's got, anyway, I don't want to get into the book three. But so it finds a crawler and the crawler is, I mean, it's like an H.P. Lovecraft thing. It's unrecognizable. It's indescribable, you know? And, but there's a lot of good descriptions about smells and scents and feels and a lot of different colors of lights and how it looks like there's, it's sort of a shimmery thing, but you can kind of see like a ghost of a hand reaching out from it and writing all the stuff on the walls. And there's kind of a ghost of a head as well, who looks like the lighthouse keeper from 30 years ago.
Who they had a photo of. Yeah.
Yes. And we find out more about him in book two and three.
Right at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. But in book two and three, you find out his story, which is pretty cool. Nice. Because we get into the origins of it all. But yeah, so the psychologist makes the anthropologist take a test tube sample and try to get it, you know, kind of brush the side of the thing and try to get some of it into the test tube. And when it does that, the crawler reacts, reaches out, and we don't know exactly what happened. But I imagine that the arm that we see just ripped that lady's jaw right off, and then she just threw her down on the ground. And then the psychologist, the psychologist got hit in the leg, I think, as well, maybe from the body of the anthropologist, because the next day she's limping and she's like, what happened? She's like, nothing, don't worry about it. But then, yeah, so we're starting to see that the psychologist is not, doesn't have everybody's best interest in mind. They are using these people for whatever they want, or perhaps whatever the Southern Reach wants. And you find out all those answers later in the other books, and it's much deeper than you would have ever suspected.
Yeah. And that's brought into fullest relief when the psychologist and surveyor get separated from the psychologist, and the biologist goes back to, is it the lighthouse? I think it is the lighthouse, right? Where and finds that the psychologist has fallen and is dying.
Yes.
And As soon as the psychologist kind of realizes who is standing there, she tries the hypnotic suggestion, annihilation, which is, she believes, supposed to cause a suicide.
Right. And that doesn't happen. And they have a little interesting conversation but the biologist kind of says, you know, I've been changed or whatever, but the psychologist already knows. They can see the glow coming out of them. And the biologist is desperately trying to get answers out of this dying psychologist, and they're just kind of laughing at them. Like, it doesn't even matter if I gave you the answers, you still wouldn't understand what's going on around here. And then the biologist ends up leaving them there. It's like, you know what? Or the psychologist passes out, and they're like, I can't do anything about this, I'm out of here. And as they're walking away across the sands, they look back and see this glow coming up off of their body up into the sky. It's always like these yellowy or golden glows, which I think comes back to right before at the end of the book when the biologist finally goes back all the way down into the tower and meets the crawler. Like you said earlier, the story kind of bounces between these few days in Area X and their past, this biologist's past. And the biologist starts, right before they go to see the crawler, they're like, you know what, let's take a little side trip back into memory lane. Let me tell you about this one time where I was drunk out on the beach at night. I was looking at the tidal pools and I saw a destroyer of worlds, which is a gigantic starfish. Lives off of coral, I think. And they're spectacular to look at. I looked up some pictures of them. But the more I thought about why that scene was put in there is because when they talk about the trails that they see in the slime that's on the stairs, it kind of looks like cilia had been, like millions of cilia had been moving around in there, but it's kind of like the tubular feet of a starfish as well. I kind of think that whatever the crawler is a mishmash of different entities. I think the Lighthouse Keeper and perhaps a Destroyer of Worlds, because Area X does go out into the ocean as well. And so maybe, you know, the crawler is here to destroy the world. They are changing the world for sure in ways that the rest of us probably can't live through as easily and still be who we are. But I kind of like that idea that it was, you know, a beautiful, destructive, gigantic organism had been fused with a human and kind of been fused with some other things. This is all kind of speculation, my point, because they don't, I don't think they actually describe exactly how everything happened, even the later books. But it was weird they said Destroyer of Worlds, and here we are looking at something that is kind of seemingly destroying things. And then after she finishes that little backstory, we get to meet the crawler for the first time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that was a wild, wild scene. That was just so weird. Because she's like, she wants to look at, she says, you know, before I turn that corner, if I had not gone any farther, the rest of my life would have been regretting this moment. So I had to look. And when she sees it, she's kind of describing it to us. And then she's like, she gets freaked out. And she tries to turn around and walk away. But then she feels its thousands of eyes turn towards her and the heat coming off of it's getting closer and closer. And she feels like she's being drowned in the ocean. Again, I love the whole idea of having light and ocean, two different things kind of being fused together. And as she's trying to walk away, she like freezes and like she feels it touch the base of her skull and then dig its way into her brain. And she says her brain exploded and then it got slowly put back together moat by moat. So it has changed her irrevocably from this point.
Right.
She felt she had some sort of, inoculation against it because she'd already had some spores in her and she was already changing. But I think that's also why it was attracted to her. It didn't just kill her like it did to the anthropologist. It's like, wait a second, you're kind of like me. I like that. Mm-hmm. And so it changes her. And then she freaks out and flees the only way she can because it's blocking her egress. So she goes farther down into the tower. And she's going down these stairs. She's going down these stairs. And here's where I think space and time get a little twisted because they said that they could see a blurred rectangle of white light at the bottom, maybe being an exit. But that's also exactly what they saw when they came into Area X the first day under hypnosis. And they turned around to see what is this weird invisible barrier? They said they could see a hazy sort of light in the same shape that, kind of a square shape. And as they're going down, if they can see it, but the tower is built like a lighthouse in a way. There are multiple layers. There's multiple floors and ceilings. How could you see that far down? The floors and ceilings must stop at some point. But as they're going down, they're getting closer and closer. They're 500 steps away, and their body just gives out on them, and they cannot move forward anymore. So they have to go back, and they have to encounter the crawler again. I mean, what a scary place to be. I think I might have just jumped. And like, that's it. I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore.
Right. Especially when you think back to, you know, some of the stuff with the doppelgangers that she was reading in the journal. And the psychologist also mentioned, you know, the precipitating incident for falling off, for falling to, you know, what eventually killed her was seeing something, you know, and backing away from it and falling.
Right. Yeah. And then in the husband's journal, he said he saw doppelgangers of everybody in his group. He saw his own doppelganger walk away from the beach, you know, away from the tower, the lighthouse, and then descend down into the tower. And it was him and one of his other buddies were still hanging out together. And they're both like freaked out, like, well, we should get out of here right away. Like, we don't want to deal with this. So it's interesting that his doppelganger was created. He saw it. And I'm presuming it was a doppelganger that came back to the biologist. Super weird. I think it'd be weird to see someone who looked a lot like me, the twin sort of thing out there in the world. Mm-hmm. But to see a true doppelganger of yourself and you realize it's not you, but it looks and can act just like you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's super scary.
Yeah. Yeah. So ultimately, you know, this book, it ends, there's not a definite ending to it, right? It's just, I'm going to head that way. Maybe I'll find my husband. Maybe I won't.
Right. Yeah, they make it out of the tower. The battle just makes it out of the tower. And in the husband's journal, he said he went to an island. You can kind of see from the shore. So she's like, I'm going to go there. Maybe he's there. Yeah. Who knows?
And she also encountered the lighthouse keeper at that point, right? Who is apparently still alive and looks exactly the same as the photo from 30 years ago.
I don't think that's correct. I think she saw the visage of the lighthouse keeper in the crawler, in the depths of its lights and whatnots. But yeah, when she went back to the lighthouse and put his picture back up on the wall, because that picture kept getting taken off and putting back on. But yeah, no, she does not encounter him. But he does make an appearance in the other books. You get to find out his backstory, which is cool.
Okay. When I think about trying to what happened in the book, right, I have all these vague notions about what actually happened, even though, you know, like I listened to the last hour today and still some of the stuff is just a little fuzzy for me. So I think I would enjoy reading further to get some more definitive answers.
Some is the operative word there. Yeah. Some.
Yes. Yeah. I'll go in with the correct expectations.
You know, it's weird how you were saying that some of the details are slipping your mind, because when I think back about this book, even right before I did this final reread, I clearly remember the first three of the five parts. You're in the depth of it. You're still out there trying to figure out what's going on before you get any answers. And then when we get to the chapters, we start getting answers, you know, like when the biologist finds the psychologist at the base of the lighthouse and they're kind of getting some answers there. That's where my mind starts slipping away. Like I keep forgetting what happened there, what just happened there, or the scene where the biologist meets the crawler. I listened to it like three times because I'm like, I think it's the word choice that makes it so vague, but the words are evocative in their own way. Like it'll make you think of things, but it doesn't tell you what you're actually looking at. You know, like a psychedelic Ray Bradbury story. Like, oh, it's beautiful. I love this story. But what is he even talking about? What's going on here anymore? Sure. My mind just kept forgetting it. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. But I did find a lot of passages in this book were beautifully written. Not, you know, purple prose, but I liked some of his analogies and the way he puts sentences together. I've got a couple here, if you don't mind me reading those out.
Yeah, go for it.
Nothing that lived and breathed was truly objective. Even in a vacuum, even if all that possessed the brain was a self-immolating desire for truth. Man, I just like the way that's put together. Or sunlight came down, dappled through the moss and leaves, creating archipelagos of light in the flat surface of the entrance. Again, that's just beautiful. It's almost poetic. It began to rain. This is after the biologist has been affected by the spores and they're being changed. It began to rain. I saw each drop fall as a perfect faceted liquid diamond, refracting light even in the gloom. And I could smell the sea and picture the rolling waves. The wind was like something alive. It entered every pore of me, and it, too, had a smell, carrying with it the earthiness of the marsh reeds. Man. I don't know. There's something about the way this guy writes. I really should read more of him.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well, the way he puts words together. I think the archipelago one, I was in that last hour that I was listening to today, and I thought, well, it was a really well-crafted sentence.
Yeah.
Do we ever, you know, asking you to tell me in future books, is there anything in the future books that validates her view of the tower as a tower rather than a tunnel?
So the idea of it being a sort of perverted mirror of the lighthouse, 100% correct. That is exactly why it's there. That's why it looks the way it does. And I don't want to tell you too much more, but it's a perversion of the lighthouse.
Okay. Nice. Now that's good enough for me. Anything else you want to talk about the book? We can move into kind of final thoughts.
I did like the sort of, as the tower and the lighthouse sort of are spirals in their own sense, I kind of like how the story itself sort of spiraled. Almost as we move forward in the chronology of now, once they're in Area X and those few days they're there, we are constantly moving backwards in time, talking about the characters, the biologist's past, their childhood, their parents, their relationship with their husband, how they met and all that. And it almost seems like as the Area X timeline moves forward, the backstory is also moving forward at a different pace. And I sort of saw that sort of spiraling around each other like a conch shell. I don't know why. Maybe like people say time's a circle, people say time's a spiral, but that I just kept thinking about like nautilus shells and how they sort of ring around each other, and everything is sort of ringing around that very first sentence when you see the tower that should not be there. I just thought that was really, really cool. I started taking notes about how the timeline moved forward and backwards, and it's really well put together. I also liked that all the backstory wasn't just there for filler. It informed you about the protagonist, about who, you know, what made them who they are, what they think is important, and why what pretty much everybody else thinks is important, they do not care about. So sometimes you read some books, do you feel like, oh, there's a lot of bloat here, a lot of fat on here. We should chop that down. I don't know how you could chop this book down. I mean, it's already, again, just barely novel length. I think it's tight. And I really wish part two was just like this one, but whatever.
Probably worth, and by way of final thoughts, I said, I'll echo what we said earlier. We're both recommending this one, and I'm definitely going to continue this series when I clear some of my current backlog, that's what I always say. And sometimes I follow through, sometimes I don't.
I get it.
But I do intend to. After I finished the audiobook a couple days ago, I was like, you know what? I've got a couple days. I could rip through the other ones, and then, of course, they're not available from the library right away. So I got to wait. There is a film adaptation of this, and it sounds like both of us were film viewers first before the book.
Yeah.
And it's interesting it's an interesting case for adaptation. We haven't done it on my adapted science fiction podcast yet. Maybe someday we will, but Alex Garland kind of talked about how his movie is more about the way the book made him feel than trying to adapt the plot of the book. And some of the feel of that movie, really, like when I think of the way the movie made me feel, I then reading the book, I'm like, yeah, okay, I can see that. Even though the movie, I think, veers more into kind of horror territory. Not that there isn't anything horrifying in the book, but it is more creepy than scary, I think, the book, where the movie has some genuinely scary moments.
Precisely. Yeah. The movie, I think, captured the beauty of the story really well. That movie is just pretty gorgeous to watch. But again, I think the big scenes in the movie are just not in the book. So if you're a huge fan of the movie and you're going to read this book, be prepared. There is no awesome, scary human bear scene. That scene is so cool. It's so cool. And that is not in the book. Remember kind of in the beginning, I think it was the first day in the movie, they encounter that massive crocodile or whatever.
Yes.
So when I went to that, the reading with Jeff Vandermeer a year ago, somebody said, so did you put a giant crocodile in your fourth book because it was in the movie? And you see the look on his face like, yes, no, no, yes.
Maybe.
I don't think he answered it. Yeah. But you're like, I'm pretty sure that's why there's a giant crocodile in the fourth book, because you put it in the movie and everybody loved it. And the whole end of that movie, I was just engrossed. I was enwrapped. I was like, I do not know what's going on. How do you even write this thing? What is that? What's that? What is this? Why did they do that? And then you get to the end of this book and you're like,
and the score to that movie too.
Oh, I didn't think about it. I'm going to rewatch it, I think, tomorrow.
Yeah. The score is tremendous.
Oh, great. I'll pay attention to that.
Yeah.
I mean, great adaptation. I mean, well, not great adaptation, but it's a great movie, and it is an adaptation. But the way it was done means you cannot continue to part two of that book series based off of that movie. You'd have to reboot the whole thing. And I often wonder about that, because the feeling, you said that sort of creepy feeling you get from the first book. I mean, there's that creepiness in the book too, but it is such a change, because you're just in like concrete office building the whole time. And I just do not think that the audiences are going to sit through that second book to get to part three. They're just like the second movie to get to part three, because it is such a tonal shift, so boring. And I don't know how they would ever do it.
No worries about that anyway, because the first movie bombed, and so there's no way they're making another one.
What, it did?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it did very poorly at the box office.
Well, I did not know that. I loved it so much. I thought it was great.
The status it has, I feel like it's almost a cult classic at this point. And it's kind of a Alex Garland special, right? Cause the Dread movie that he did, that he kind of shadow directed as well. Like it bombed too. And it's fantastic. So,
yeah, it's the best Dread movie out there.
Yeah, it is, and by far. Anywho. Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Right. So I think we're wrapped. Matthias, I don't think you have any. Do you have any social media you want to give out, or you just want to point people to the Discord?
I've got some social media. I quit using Facebook like 10 years ago. It's still there, and it's like an emergency thing for people I've met. I don't really use it. But yeah, I'm on Reddit all the time, but I'll never tell you my handle. So yes, you can find me at Matthias at the Nebulugo Book Club, which I'm sure you can find a link to right below this video. Yeah, stop on by, say hi. We're pretty fly for a sci-fi guy. It's very casual. I kind of see it as like a private-ish room in a library. We're surrounded by books, almost mostly exclusively sci-fi, but we can talk about whatever we want. I personally kind of keep myself PG-13, but I don't hold that standard to anybody else. I see myself as a dedicant and a secretary, even though I am the leader. But it's very casual. I've never had to put my foot down and tell people, don't do that. Never had to kick anybody out. Because people are just nice. We just really talk about books, you know. Come in, make a comment on a previous book we've already read, start up a new conversation. You never know what's going
to
happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one thing that I really like about the fact that it does have that asynchronous thing to it where it's like, oh, I just read Doomsday Book or something. You can go back and comment on that thread and people engage with you. It's really cool.
Yeah. I try to put at least something in every time somebody talks about an old book or at least point them to, oh, you like that book? Why don't you take a look at the discussion we had? Maybe you'll have some new answers or some new questions.
Yeah.
But yeah, just come in and talk about books, mostly sci-fi.
All right. Sounds good. All right, Matthias, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. It's always great to talk to you.
Yeah, always nice to talk to you. We should do pub quiz one of these days.
We definitely have to do that, man.
get Bike Muffin in on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's what we need in the Discord is more Portland folks. Or you know what? We need more West Side folks. More folks who live over where I do.
Okay, sure. So then I have to cross the river. I'm the one guy without a car. I got to cross the river. Okay.
Hey, man, I came to you that one time. So
Right. It was nice. Thank you. Yeah, it was nice to meet you.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll interact at least on the Discord. So talk to you later, man.
All right. Have a good night.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Matthias. And if there's one thing you take away from this, do join us on the Nebulugo Book Club Discord. If you are somebody who is interested in reading the Hugos and Nebulas, you don't have to necessarily set out to read all of them. But if you like discussing those books, if you like this kind of episode, there's great discussions over there. So reach out to me. I'll put an invite link in the show notes so you can just go through that if you're getting to this in a timely manner. If not, reach out to me another time and I will get you that. All right. I think that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.